Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on beautiful children's Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
We hear about these laws or about legal cases where it seems as though two equal and opposite forces are meeting together and neither gives way to the other. On the one side, you have religious liberty, which is, by the way, guaranteed us in the Constitution. On the other side, you have the so-called SOGI laws, that's sexual orientation and gender identity laws, that are written with the assumption of some kind of discrimination taking place. Often discrimination isn't clearly defined, a need isn't clearly demonstrated, but the laws are being written and more of them every day are appearing. We're going to talk about religious liberty and SOGI laws. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Ryan Anderson joins us. He's a regular guest. He's Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy for the Heritage Foundation, founder and editor of Public Discourse, and author of the book Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, and a new essay, How to Think About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Laws and Religious Freedom. Ryan, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Not legally speaking, but politically and practically speaking, is it going to be possible to craft laws that would both protect the rights of LGBTQ persons and fully protect religious liberty?
So practically speaking, the rights of people who identify as LGBT already are fully protected. Practically speaking, they have the right to live their lives how they want to live their lives. The government's not coercing them to behave a certain way or to do certain things. The problems that we see practically speaking, and I think legally speaking as well, is that the government is coercing people who have disagreements about certain aspects of beliefs about marriage, belief about human embodiment as male and female, beliefs about human sexuality, and therefore the government's violating the religious liberty rights of those Americans. So the concern here isn't so much of can we protect both LGBT rights and religious liberty, as much as it is that we are now creating laws based on sexual orientation and gender identity to address a largely non-existent problem to then coerce and violate the religious liberty rights of other Americans.
So then how is it that we hear so often that the rights of LGBTQ persons are constantly violated and run over roughshod?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is, you know, what do we think natural rights are? What do we think human rights are? What do we think civil rights are? There isn't a natural right to have a Catholic hospital perform a sex reassignment surgery on you. But yet when people talk about LGBT rights and when they file lawsuits, that's one of the examples that they are talking about. There isn't a natural right to have a Catholic adoption agency place a child up for adoption with a same-sex couple. There isn't a natural right to have an evangelical florist arrange flowers for your wedding. And yet there is a natural right to the free exercise of religion. There's a human right to the free exercise of religion. There's a constitutional right to the free exercise of religion. And yet the Catholic charity adoption agencies have been forced to close in several states. We saw just yesterday a florist in Washington State lost her appeal at the Washington State Supreme Court. She's now appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court because she declined to do flowers for a same-sex wedding, even though she's employed gay employees and she had served this particular gay couple for a decade. And now we've seen just earlier this year a lawsuit filed against a Catholic hospital in New Jersey, not because they refuse to treat people who identify as transgender. They'll do chemotherapy for people who identify as transgender, but they won't do sex reassignment surgeries. That's the problem here.
So you talk first about being able to demonstrate a need. What in particular is that?
Sure. I mean, historically, we've enacted anti-discrimination law not because there's a human right to anti-discrimination law, so we wouldn't say that these are things that you have a right to, but because there was a need. And so in the South, in the aftermath of slavery and then the reality of Jim Crow laws, there was a need that African Americans had for equality, for dignity, for the ability to live their lives as they saw appropriate. But because of the legacy of Jim Crow, because of white supremacy, because of an unjust system of racism, they were blocked. They were limited. They were unable to sit at the lunch counter. They were unable to have equal opportunities. And so an anti-discrimination policy was an appropriate response to the needs at the time. So the question today is, what sort of needs are there for people who identify as LGBT? And what would be an appropriately crafted policy to address those needs? But it's simply bad policymaking to take the anti-discrimination laws that we passed in the 1960s to address the problem of racism and add the phrase sexual orientation and gender identity to those existing statutes and say that's the appropriate way to address whatever the need is today for people who identify as LGBT. We need to have laws that are crafted to respond to particular policy problems and not simply proliferate anti-discrimination laws.
Is part of the problem there that the assertion is kind of made, well, the law is kind of becoming ever more enlightened on all these issues. So in effect, the civil rights laws, what they really intend to do is leave a bunch of blanks after race or ethnicity that we can fill in later with whatever we see fit. And they'll all be viewed as the equivalent of race and ethnicity. And they'll all be viewed, the discrimination that is alleged will all be viewed as the equivalent of racial discrimination.
That's part of the problem in the rhetoric. But actually, if you look at how some of the anti-discrimination laws that came immediately after the Civil Rights Act of 64, is that they were much more nuanced. So our anti-discrimination laws for race are much more stringent than our anti-discrimination laws for sex. Our anti-discrimination laws for race, for example, say you can't have black water fountains and white water fountains, and that's appropriate for the law to say that. But they say you can have male bathrooms and female bathrooms. The problem now is that if you add gender identity as a protected class, it says that you have to allow a man who claims to be a woman into the woman's restroom, or a woman who claims to be a man into the men's restroom. See, they're not appropriately defined, whereas we did make distinctions between race isn't relevant for the bathroom, so that's an unjust form of discrimination, but sex, biological sex, is relevant, so a ban on sex discrimination never classified single-sex facilities as sex-based discrimination. Likewise, there were greater religious liberty exemptions for anti-discrimination law on the basis of sex than there are for race. So there's an entire waiver for Title IX, the ban on sex discrimination in higher education and all education, federally funded education. But there isn't a religious waiver for the Civil Rights Act of 64. So we had more nuance here as to when we thought a factor was relevant, when we exempted people, how we defined what was discriminatory. And right now, unfortunately, it seems that many people simply want to say any action that we disagree with, we will now view as a form of discrimination.
You talk about defining terms and the need for it. What terms are ill-defined or, in some cases, even legally undefined?
Sure. I mean, here you have a problem that many of these SOGI laws, as they're called, sexual orientation and gender identity laws, offer no definition, no objective standard for how to understand sexual orientation or gender identity. That gender identity is simply defined as an internal sense of gender. And if it's an internal sense of gender, then it's entirely subjective. And some of them even explicitly say it could be male, female, neither, both, or somewhere in between. Your gender identity can be on a spectrum. Your gender identity can change day to day, hour to hour. Your gender identity can be neither male or female, or it could be both male and female. If that's your internal sense of gender, then it's very hard to understand what we're supposed to do when it comes to dormitories or hotel rooms for grade school overnight field trips or locker rooms or shower facilities or sports teams. If you say that gender identity is now a protected class in law, that's one of the problems with some of these terms.
You say that a lot of the laws that have been put into place are unjustified. What do you mean by that?
Sure. I mean, the problem here is that many of these sweeping SOGI laws are in response to a non-existent policy problem that's commiserate with the scope of the law. So if you simply add the phrase sexual orientation and gender identity to the same anti-discrimination law that protects on the basis of race, you would expect that the need, the problem that justifies the law, would be of the same magnitude as the need and the problem that justified the protection on race. But that's not the case. So we have laws that are burdening religious schools, religious charities, religious businesses, and they're burdening those businesses without a corresponding justification. And that's one of the things that makes these laws unjust. They penalize people who are acting on the truth about marriage. And living out the truth, there's never a justification for penalizing people who engage in rightful actions.
So in other words, they really are infringing upon freedom of thought, conscience, and in many, many cases, religion.
Now, they would say they're not infringing upon freedom of thought. You're free to think whatever you want to think. You're free to believe whatever you want to believe. And that's why they'll say we defend the freedom of worship. But they're infringing upon the free exercise of religion. You're not able to live out those thoughts and those beliefs. They're infringing upon freedom of association, freedom of expression, freedom of contract, right? How do we actually live out our thoughts and our beliefs and our convictions, whether it's in the schools that we run, the charities that we operate, the businesses that we run? That's kind of where the rubber hits the road as to whether or not the government's going to let you live out your convictions. Because what's the point of having convictions if you're not able to actually live them out and give them expression?
Ryan Anderson is our guest. We're talking about religious liberty and sexual orientation and gender identity laws. He's author of the book, Truth Overruled, and a recent essay, How to Think About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Policies and Religious Freedom. More with him after this.
Dr. Anthony Eslin will be speaking on the topic of imagination and education at the second annual Wittenberg Academy Family Retreat, which will be held at Camp Okoboji in Milford, Iowa on April 27th through the 29th, 2017. Join us and be immersed in God's Word, thoughtful discussions, and family fun. For more information or to register, visit www.wittenbergacademy.org and click on the registration tab.
O Lord, open my lips.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Make haste, O God, to deliver me.
Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live, weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Greetings in Christ, and thank you for listening to Issues Etc. If you ever find yourself visiting the Smoky Mountains in East Tennessee, please join us here at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Sevierville. We see it as a small part of our service to the church to provide sound liturgical worship opportunities for vacationing Lutherans to our area. For worship times and directions, please visit our website at splctn.com. That's splctn.com.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
What are some of the myths of gospel reductionism? I've written part two of an article titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel in the latest Issues, Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joy Pullman of The Federalist writes about her journey from charismatic experientialism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Did you make a New Year's resolution to get in shape this year? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness at Edwardsville. You could even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness can help you keep your New Year's resolution. Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. PerformanceFitness618.com.
Second wave feminism originated with these white, educated, middle and upper class women. And then women from minority groups came and said, well, your way of life only works because we've been raising your kids and cleaning your houses and doing all these nasty jobs that you don't want to do because you think you should all be pilots and CEOs.
I know some prophets who literally have a prophetic batting average worse than a National League bullpen pitcher right now.
It's not a coincidence that you hear women who say, I don't understand, I'm so successful in life or at my job, but when it comes to love, I'm not successful.
It's one thing to have same-sex attraction and be repentant of it and cling to Christ for forgiveness and the strength to resist the desire. We need to distinguish from that and those who would affirm same-sex attraction as well as acting on it.
In 1 hour, we're going to be playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. There's just a taste of the four soundbites. We'll play them for you in their entirety in about an hour from now. And then after you've listened, you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. You send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or you go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and vote right there. Remember to tell us where you're listening and why you're voting for the soundbite you're voting for. It's also your opportunity to win the LPR bundle package that we give away every Friday. And you can vote in advance, facebook.com/issuesetc, facebook.com/issuesetc. Ryan Anderson is our guest. We're talking about religious liberty and SOGI laws. Ryan, have you come across any SOGI laws that meet the criteria we've been discussing here?
No. Unfortunately, there's nothing like this that has actually been produced, partly because there's an unwillingness on the side of progressives to reach such a compromise. They want to say not just that legitimately unjust discrimination should be unlawful, but many activists say that anyone who believes that we're created male and female and that male and female are created for each other and seeks to live out that belief in public life should be penalized. So it's not simply unjust discrimination, or they'll define living out those belief sets as unjust discrimination.
Can you explain to me how this snuck up on us? I mean, I think there were some who saw it coming, although they might have said, say, a decade ago, it'll be here 25 years from now, not a decade from now. But most of us, this kind of crept up on us, and suddenly the goalposts on word definitions, what gender is, what identity is, all seem to have been moved almost overnight. How did it happen?
Well, so I mean, I think this goes back quite a ways. Depending on how far you want to go back, we could go back to nominalism and voluntarism in the Middle Ages, or we could go more immediately, I think, to the sexual revolution. That this is a problem that starts in the more immediate term of history in the 1960s, and it starts within heterosexual communities. The sexual revolution gave us a radically new understanding of the human person and of the human body and the purposes of human sexuality and of the human family. It gave rise to the hookup culture, the normalization of premarital sex, the normalization of cohabitation, the high rates of non-marital childbearing, the introduction of no-fault divorce, the more than doubling in the rates of divorce. It's after two generations of straight people not respecting the truth about human sexuality that we then see other changes take place. And that's where I think you then see sexual orientation and gender identity challenges coming to the fore. If the only thing that matters is consent, that consenting adults should do sexually whatever consenting adults want to do, then the next thing you know that we're going to be able to claim a protected class status based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And I think that's how you asked, you know, how did this come up? I think that's where this came from.
Is the kind of the most potent but most fallacious argument that's being made here, the one-for-one relationship that is being proposed with race and sex discrimination when it came to women?
Sure. I mean, I think part of this is that there's an attempt to say the way that we in America treat racists, the way that we treat people who are against interracial marriage, is the same way in which we should treat homophobic bigots, people who are against same-sex marriage. And so because the label of racism is such a strong label, and rightly so, racism is profoundly evil, and so to call someone a racist, to use that label as a signifier, matters. There's now been an attempt to say that Orthodox Jews, Roman Catholics, Evangelical Christians, Latter-day Saints, Muslims, and many other people who believe we're created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other, are the functional equivalent of racists. That's kind of the cultural push that we're seeing.
And it found its way so quickly to the highest echelons of our government, including the Obergefell decision and the opinion, at least part of the opinion, written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. How significant was his rationale, if it can be called that, in that decision?
Well, I don't think the rationale was significant because there was no rationale. What was significant was the conclusion. The conclusion here was that the U.S. Supreme Court was taking authority away from the American people to make their own marriage laws, and five unelected judges were imposing their personal beliefs about marriage on the entire country and then claiming the Constitution required it. And what that did was it poured gasoline on the culture war, and it empowered the activists on the left who were already in the ascendancy. They had Hollywood, they had big business, they had big media, they had big law, they had big labor all on their side. They now had the Supreme Court on their side. And that's why you see the boycotts of states like Indiana and North Carolina, states that tried to protect religious freedom and privacy, respectively. This simply empowered the cultural left to be more of a bully.
Is there a need for SOGI laws?
No, I mean, there has not been a documented need for the types of SOGI laws that we have seen. If there is a need for other less cumbersome policies, that's a possibility. You can't definitively say there is no need, but it hasn't been documented. And someone that's advocating for new laws would need to do the work of actually showing the justification.
And yet the laws are being written and they're being passed. At what point is there kind of a critical mass here legally where it simply just becomes, it has the force of precedent and no one will question it any longer?
Well, they need to be passed either at the state level in all 50 states or at the federal level by Congress. And so far there isn't a federal SOGI law. And so far, less than half of the states have passed SOGI laws. So it's not a matter of critical mass. You would actually need to enact this legislation. I mean, hopefully what will happen is that no additional SOGI laws will be enacted because they're not justified under current circumstances.
Are you concerned or relieved by the presence of Donald Trump in the White House, who has kind of sent mixed messages on what he supports or doesn't support when it comes to these things?
It's unclear. He ran on a platform of protecting religious freedom. There was a great executive order draft that was leaked to hostile media and hostile activist groups on the left. And so far, that executive order hasn't been issued. It's vitally important that President Trump honors the promises that he made to protect religious freedom, that this executive order is issued, and then that Congress passes law that will make those protections permanent.
Finally, what kind of criticism has your recent essay on religious liberty and SOGI laws received, and how do you respond to your critics?
So far, there's really only been one critical response, and it was simply a misreading by an activist at Think Progress. And he simply didn't actually engage in the argumentation. So for someone like that, where I think it's actually a willful misreading and a failure to actually engage with the argumentation, there's not much you can say. You just let readers read his critique and read my original report, and they'll see where the truth lies.
Ryan Anderson is Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy for the Heritage Foundation, founder and editor of Public Discourse, author of the book Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, and a new essay, How to Think About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Policies and Religious Freedom. You can find his book and read his essay at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Ryan, thank you very much and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
The House voted to overturn a rule banning states from denying federal funds to abortion providers, including the big one, Planned Parenthood. We're going to talk about that with the president of National Right to Life, Carol Tobias, right after this. At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.